Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the press conference of the Cycling Podcast on the Tour de France. Questions in French and English only, questions en français et en anglais uniquement. No questions will be taken on the Anglo-French relationship.
François Thomazeau there setting the rules for our press conference episode. This is part two. We released part one on the second rest day, and this is coming just after the second rest day, although it was recorded on the second rest day. Bit of a backlog. We're working through your questions. I'm with Lionel Burney and François Thomazeau. My name's Richard Moore. Let's crack on with the first question.
Hello, Cycling Podcast. My name's Martin Greenup, and I'm from Carlisle in Cumbria in the north of England. My question today is not so much about cycling as about the Cycling Podcast itself. In particular, I'm interested in hearing how each of you prepares ahead of an episode. Do each of you have any rituals or routines to help you get in the zone, as it were, before you record? Where does the chemistry of the group come from? In short, I'm asking, what's the Cycling Podcast equivalent of going on the rollers before a team time trial?
Well, thank you for that question, Martin. We heard an abbreviated version of it there. I mean, how do we prepare? We don't really, which sounds terrible, but I think when we started off the podcast, there was an expectation from some people within the group that we should prepare and almost not script it quite, but have a very clear idea about what we were going to cover. And I think what you lose then is a spontaneity that comes with surprising things coming up, you know. And I think the great thing of why it works, if it works, is that, you know, Lionel or Francois or Daniel or Orla will say something that I hadn't thought of and that gets you thinking as you're speaking on air, as it were. So I like that spontaneity. I think it makes it, it gives us all a bit more energy most of the time.
Yeah, I think one of the problems with doing it off the cuff is that you tend to make more mistakes, I think. So the bits that I prepare, I do prepare the tale of the etap and try not to make it sound too much like it's been scripted. But, you know, sometimes, you know, you can only summarize the important bits of the day. It's not supposed to be like a, you know, a blow-by-blow account of the stage. But I think you're right, Richard. But when you say that about the early days, I certainly would have been more comfortable with like a running order and, right, what are we talking about in this section and so on. But that was because we were new to it and it was we were just finding our way. But now I think we're in a bit more of a groove, aren't we?
And I think when you're at the Tour de France, you're not really setting aside time to prepare. You are absorbing the Tour de France all the time. You're living it. And, you know, we stayed with friends of yours, Francois, a couple of nights ago, and I was very conscious that we were just talking about the Tour de France the whole time because, and you know, and there were moments where we had to come out and pretend to be sort of normal people again and have normal conversations about other things. But you are so absorbed into this and you absorb it to such an extent that it's very difficult to really talk about anything else. And so what you're hearing on the podcast is just pretty much what we talk about all the time at the Tour.
I think it depends on personalities and temperaments and things. I mean, I've always been very much in favor of improvisation. I mean, when I really like and enjoy, that's why I like to do the events that the Cycling Podcast do. I like to talk in public. That's one of the things I like to do. And I never ever prepare, because if I do, I'm more stressed and I'm you know, I'm worried that I might forget things. So I've got a rough ideas and a couple of formulas that I think, oh, and a couple of, you know, sentences and catchphrases. And I think, oh, I have to make sure I'll say this because it sounds funny or anything. But I know that there will come a time when an idea I had, or a nice little one-liner I wrote down, it will come up at some stage. So I really love to let you know the flow go, and you know it's more like a dialogue and that's what basically what Richard just said. I mean, how do I prepare for the podcast? I think I had 30 years of preparation for it, in a way, because I mean, covering the tour for so many years, the preparation you do at home, you do every day throughout the year, being kind of an expert in cycling, having lived the experience, having read those books, and normally it all comes back at the right moment when you need them. So yes, of course, there's the usual mistake, like you can say it was 1996 and it was 1995, but it's part of the spontaneity of it. Mm-hmm. And I think it also provides a chance, you know, in the next episode to correct the mistake you did the day before. So yeah, for me, the least preparation, the better it is.
It's funny, I think we're taking both a macro and a micro view of the tour, aren't we? And that's what we're trying to convey in an episode. What we're not doing is the real kind of mid-range detail work. And I think, you know, when you're talking off a couple of days ago, I said Geraint Thomas had been lying fourth overall 2 years ago. It was 3 years ago, you know, and those mistakes kind of just are a part of the tapestry of the podcast, because we're not doing it with absolutely every resource at our fingertips. And I think that, generally in terms of how we put together an episode, well, we, as soon as a stage finishes, we go out to either the finish line or the team buses, we gather some material, we overhear things, we talk to people, and then we kind of gather together, what have we got, what can we open the episode with, what interviews do we have, what topics are we going to discuss, and we kind of leave it as loose as that, really. And then, well, you listen to the podcast, you hear it's in three distinct parts, and we try to cover slightly different ground in each of the three parts, and generally it gets a bit looser and more freeform as it goes on, doesn't it?
Maybe it needs to be said here that covering the tour is a lesson in flexibility, because when I was working for the written press, very often you go to the village in the morning and to the buses, and you think, this is the story I'm going to write, and the guy you're looking for an interview, you never find him. So you really need to find another story to tell, and which means that when you're getting to the buses and we record audio and tape and interviews for the podcast, you don't always get what you want, but sometimes you get things you didn't expect to get, and that they're even better. So you have to adapt to what you get, and that's the level of spontaneity that makes the podcast interesting.
But in terms of the chemistry, I think we're all quite different in how we work, what we're interested in, and those three parts make up the whole, and that kind of works whether it's me, Richard, and Daniel, or as it is here with you, Francois. We've all got a slightly different take on things. Unless suddenly somebody decides to just create a ridiculous argument by saying something about Egg and Bernal that they just don't even believe.
A community around the world, stories and films with the most compelling characters, the world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Hi, it's Fleck from Rafa. At Rafa, we believe that cycling transforms lives and that cycling is the answer to many of our daily problems and challenges. For me, it gives me the headspace to think about the people dearest to me and focus on the most important things in life. It's amazing where your mind goes when you give it time to wonder. We have 23 Rafa clubhouses around the world with 300 rides a week with thousands of people. So wherever you are, we invite you to ride with us. Head to rafa.cc to find a ride near you.
Hi guys, Alan here from Ireland, friend of the podcast. Love your work, keep it up. Query in relation to an interview there with Doug Ryder after Mark Cavendish got eliminated. You do wonder, this was telegraphed a long way out, that Cavendish and all the sprinters were going to have difficulty over these mountains with the time cut. Why is there any explanation as to why there was no Dimension Data train similar to the Sky train protecting Cavendish, making sure he makes that time cut and bringing him on to, you know, it's their only chance maybe getting some glory in the last few sprint stages that are available. No matter where it is in the field, you know, stick four or five riders with Cavendish and let them burn off, because they don't seem to be having any other luck in the race. Just a very strange tactics not to stick every rider with Cavendish to bring him home safe and get him to Paris. Just interested in your thoughts on that. Thanks.
Well, an interesting point, Alan. I suspect that the answer it owes to Cavendish's waning powers, really. I mean, had the team being confident that if he got through these stages, he would deliver a sprint win, then maybe they would have dedicated more resources to helping him. But that can backfire too. We saw it last year with FDJ, and they surrounded Arnaud Démare, who I think was unwell, with teammates, and they all got eliminated. So they lost, you know, half their team in trying to keep Arnaud Démare in the race. So it's tricky. The rider who used to shepherd Cavendish through these stages, Bernie Eisele, who's missing this year, and he really used to keep Cavendish going. I mean, the great stories about them falling out on the Tourmalet and riding up the Tourmalet on opposite sides of the road and not speaking to each other until one of them went back to the car and got the other one a Coke. But you know, he was the guy that used to keep Cavendish going through these mountain stages. And I just think he's missing, but also it's a sign of you know, if Dimension Data were to you know, send three or four teammates back to help Cavendish, it might not have a desired result in terms of delivering the win that they need if Cavendish does survive the mountains.
Hi guys, it's Rob from London. Really enjoying coverage so far, as ever, and a really enjoyable tour. After the bonfire of the sprinters the other day, do you think that if Grand Tours continue with the shorter stages, which seem more severe on the sprinters in terms of the restrictions, do you think they'll also look at extending those limits so that we still have more sprinters towards the stage?
Yeah, I mean, this has been a big feature of the middle week of the tour. Le Grand Bornand, stage 10, the final group of sprinters, which includes certainly Cavendish, Groenewegen and Kittel, they made it by 28 seconds. At La Rossière, Kittel and Cavendish were both out. I mean, Cavendish way out. I mean, that was not a near miss. And then at Alpe d'Huez, several teams asked, is the time cut a mistake? You know, or can it be extended? Because the margin was so tight. They'd actually extended it the previous day to La Rosière by another 2% to give a chance. That wouldn't have saved Kittel and Cavendish anyway. But these kind of short stages with an awful lot of climbing do pose a problem for the sprinters because they're going to lose, if it goes straight up, they're going to lose quarter of an hour, maybe 10 minutes, quarter of an hour on the first climb. And then how much of that can they recoup on the descent and in the valley, and then lose another quarter of an hour? And then before you're getting to the final climb, they're already on the cusp of missing the time cut. And you have to kind of ask, what is the purpose of the time cut? The purpose of the time cut is not to deny the Tour de France of all the sprinters with potentially 3-4 sprint stages still to come. So I think they need to look at that because in the old days, it was all about making sure that the big group of sprinters didn't just roll through and have the easiest possible day and finish an hour behind you know, make a slight mockery of the tour, because there's also a logistical aspect to this. You know, they've got to keep the roads closed while the race is still on. And while I saw at La Rosière, you know, people were pretty grumpy that Cavendish was an hour and 3 or 4 minutes.
The whole
Tour de France was waiting before Cavendish could. Before Cavendish crossed the line, before anyone could leave La Rosière.
I mean, one of the issues that Doug Ryder mentioned the other day was that the sprinters are getting more specialists, and you know, they're pushing bigger gears, they're more muscular, it makes them less well suited to getting up climbs. But also the GC guys, it used to be that said that the sprinters made up time on the descents. They're racing the descents now, the GC guys. They didn't used to. You know, the race was almost neutralized on a descent. I can think of very few occasions when you know, breaks have been made on descents. I mean, things have happened like crashes and so on, but these days they're racing on every inch of the road, and that makes it also harder. I loved, you know, we played a bit of Ian Boswell's diary the other night, and I loved the scene that he painted, well, Rick Zabel painted, of the broom wagon, you know, which very few riders get in nowadays. But he had Andre Greipel, Fernando Gaviria, Dylan Groenewegen, Rick Zabel, all these great sprinters sitting together in the broom wagon.
Sitcom.
To be a fly on the wall there would have been wonderful.
Yeah, a comedy sitcom. Let's get it made.
In the same time, I mean, as the broom wagon is part of the of, you know, I mean, not the broom wagon, the gruppetto, you know, and the is part of the history of the tour. And it's also part of riding the tour and organizing the gruppetto. In the old days, you had guys who were almost paid for that. They were very good at it. They were setting the pace and making sure everybody got there on time.
some from time to time waiting for guys or, you know, well, you know, pacing themselves to do it. Maybe there's no more of these guys in the peloton these days, or fewer of them. Well, you mentioned Bernie Eisele, but Bernie Eisele could do this very well. Or Jens Voigt, when he was sometimes dropped, you know, would organize the gruppetto and tell the guys, let's get going. So maybe the time cut was a little bit too tight this time around, but it's also part, you know, what's happening at the, you know, down the road in the gruppetto during the mountain stages is important, and the other way. I mean, the first 9 days of the tour must have been a nightmare for the climbers, and you know, and in the same time, so maybe they made the time cut because it's flat, but in the same time, the impact on their bodies. I mean, we were talking about Landa crashing and other guys crashing, and remember times when, you know, Movistar or other Spanish teams were taken in echelons because it can't ride this sort of things. So in the end, isn't there a balance there that? You see,
there is a balance there, but the issue is, if you've got a 100-kilometer stage, then the time cut of whatever it ends up being, 12 or 15% or whatever, is going to be much less generous than if you've got a 200-kilometer stage. But the climbers are going to lose the same amount of time on the climb. So you can lose 90% of this. Is the point? You can lose 75% of the time you can afford to lose on the first two climbs.
My impression on this is that this year the tour organizers, and Thierry Gouvenou especially, they wanted to make sure the rules were the rules and were respected. Mm. Because remember, 1 year in the Vuelta, half the peloton was outside the time limit, and they got all back in. So you know, which in a sense made it look even more ridiculous. Because if you put, you know, impose time cuts and they're not respected, then don't impose time cuts.
I definitely agree with that. Yeah, better that a handful or half a dozen of the best sprinters are eliminated than, you know, 40 riders, 50 riders finish thinking, well, they'll never chuck us out, because that used to happen as well. You know, back in the day, the strength in numbers, really,
and also in a way, I mean, you know, it's some of the sprinters did, you know, work hard, and I mean, I don't think Arnaud Démare, I mean, he showed it last year. He's good on the climbs. He managed to get through. Well, I know the implication there of some of you guys, but innuendos might come there. But I mean, some of the, well, Peter Sagan and other guys, you know, managed. Alexander Kristoff, they managed to do it. So it was not impossible.
The cycling podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, last question, please. Dernière question, s'il vous plaît.
Evening, fellas. Todd here from Brighton in the UK to ask a quick question for the press conference. Just wondering, before you guys started making money for Old Rope by having a chat about a bike race once every week, I guess you're all trying to be serious journalists. Having only joined the fan club about this time last year or just before for the Giro, I was just wondering, how did you transition from what I believe was covering the race for other publications and then making a podcast on the side? Because I take it, with the amount you guys put out now, that is your main focus. I was just wondering if you still wrote for anyone in particular, or were freelance, or kind of what the rest of your race was made up of around the cycling podcast. Thanks very much. Keep making good stuff. Cheers.
I love that distinction between serious journalism and podcasting.
Thanks, Todd, for that. Let's distill your question into that. Actually, the story about how the podcast started is on our website, isn't it? I wrote a piece about that for The Author magazine, and the story is there about how it started back in 2013, 5 years ago. There's a sort of interesting dimension to your question, because I know what you're getting at. The podcast sort of straddles the worlds of journalism and, dare I say it, I don't want to sound like David Brent.
We're entertainers, Rich.
No, but it's different. No. It is different. There's a different flavor to it. And I like to think that it includes serious journalism, obviously, but there's also, you know, humor, and lightheartedness as well. Because I think one of the things that we felt, me, you, and Daniel Lionel, was that cycling journalism had, due to the years of doping scandals and so on, it had become quite earnest, quite pole-faced a lot of the time, quite serious. People taking themselves very seriously in cycling journalism.
We can't be accused of that.
No, but there is, I think that was definitely a trend. And we were keen to throw a light onto some of the more humorous aspects of the sport and some of the more interesting and colourful characters in the sport. Mm. So I hope that, you know, there is obviously serious journalism. I mean, you know, sometimes some of the French specials we do in particular are real. We would take those as seriously as anything we were doing, any piece of writing we were doing.
Well, I think we take everything seriously. We don't take ourselves too seriously. I don't think we do. I mean, obviously the off mic tantrums and you know, it's like I mean, sometimes we have to be brought back round the table, don't we? The following night. No, that's absolutely not true. That's absolutely not true. Before anyone tries to drive a Thomas versus Froome style wedge into the middle of the cycling podcast, I think one of the great joys of it is that it is good fun, and I think the Tour de France is fun, even when you think, oh, there's going to be a routine day, and I certainly don't want to make light of what Gianni Moscon did yesterday, but the Tour throws up stories, it throws up something different every day, even when on the face of it you might think, well, you know, the GC battle is kind of done and dusted. But I think we tried to capture and convey all of that in a way that is sometimes serious and sometimes lighthearted, but hopefully never frivolous. I think
there are moments to be serious, of course. I mean, there are very serious issues in the sport, and I think we all enjoy that as well. You know, we all enjoy getting our teeth into a serious story. And Kilometer Zero last week that Francois did on the Festina scandal was a fantastic insight into, you know, covering a really serious story and going about it in a very serious way. And we all love that too. But we, you know, as you say, Lionel, there are other moments on the Tour, and there are other stories to be told, and I think they weren't perhaps being told. I mean, you're right that we have made the transition from writing to audio pretty much full time. I mean, I still do a bit of writing. You still do a bit of writing, Lionel, but
a little bit,
but less and less. And that's partly to do with the way the media landscape is changing as well. You know, the written press is in trouble. We find that audio has great strengths.
Well, I know you mentioned, Richard, your piece that you wrote for The Author, which when I read it was terrific, and it really kind of put into black and white the process of how the podcast actually came about in a way that I'd not even really thought of. But just to save Todd and others having to go and find
wade
that on our
that
way through, yeah, because it goes on a bit, Rich. but I think that's that's a serious point there, really, is that you can convey so much more in a conversation than you perhaps can in a written piece. But from the point of view of how the podcast came about, it was beginning to look necessary because of a sort of demise in print written journalism. You know, who knows, if had we carried on the same path of 2012-2013, I may not have managed to come to the Tour in 2014-2015. Who knows? I mean, it wasn't that work was drying up, it was just that you were having to do more for the same kind of return.
I think that it sort of taps into the distrust there is of the media a little bit. And I think through the podcast we can there's a transparency to it, because you can hear us kind of weighing things up, talking things through, and not just, you know, presenting you with our words on a page. It's a process by which we're trying to, you know, establish, you know, what matters, what doesn't, what's true, what isn't. And the nuance and the, you know, is very important in cycling. And I think that comes across when you hear people talking.
But from Francois's point of view, I mean, is there a culture of podcasting in France?
No, podcast. I mean, all my French colleagues are amazed that they ask me what I'm doing, and they're not quite sure, because podcasts are not really taking on at all in France. That there are some. I mean, France Culture has very good ones, and especially, you know, the French public radio.
Why do you think that is? Because everyone in France has a smartphone.
Yeah, I think it is because...
It's a French cultural thing.
Yeah, no, well, exactly. But in this case, it's very true. The way the radio is consumed, I should say, in France is very different as it is in England. For the past 50 years, the French wake up in the morning, put on the radio, and listen what we call the peripheric radios. That's our Radio Monte Carlo, RTL, that's Radio TV Luxembourg, Europe Number One, France Inter. It's been for the past 50 years the main outlet of news for the French has always been the radio. The news have always come this way, and there's a strong competition between various networks in the southwest. You have Sud Radio as well. So it's for the French, listening to the radio is part of the daily life. You shave yourself, you listen to your favorite radio, being Europe Number One, being RTL, that's more popular, being France Inter if you're an intellectual or, you know, or left wing. I mean, and so it's still part of the daily life to hear news live between 7 and 9 in the morning, which are really the time during the day when the people are listening to the radio. So to change all that and tell the guys, you know, forget about a 7 to 9 you know, radio you know, listening kind of right, and go and you know, download podcasts or listen to podcasts, it's not taken yet. I'm sure it will, but for the time being, people think I work for a radio, you know?
But I think we have the same culture in Britain. Radio 4, the Today program, Radio 5 with the kind of you know, the slightly lighter news and sport. Yeah,
but it's all the BBC.
Radio 1,
it's all the BBC, you see, when in France it's private networks, and it's very and they're very powerful, you know, you can see them on the race. I mean, they've got cars all over the place, and so yeah, I mean, the shift hasn't been made yet. I don't know why. I think it's a really great format. It's very entertaining, very interesting. It allows for, you know, lots of things to be said that we can't, you know, doing as you say, in writing, or even, you know, or even radio doesn't do this type of format, because radio is more much tighter. We saw the radio guys when you do interview, it's like 3 questions. Please answer in short one sentence phrases, and we can, you know, that's I'm sure in the long term it will take, because I mean, for other things like, you know, street live streaming of films or thing, I mean, young people do that a lot. I mean, Netflix is as popular in France as it is anywhere else, so I can't see any reason why podcasts won't finally make it, but it's not the case for now.
Well, I think that's all we've got time for. Part 2 of our press conference from the second rest day. We'll return at the end of the tour, well, after the tour finishes, with our 3rd press conference from the Tour de France. But in the meantime, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Francois.
Merci.